In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jay Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Indeed. Jay Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons, the man that helps put it all together for us. Eddie Garrison does that from time to time, but Landon tonight capably filling in and masterfully pushing all of the buttons that make it possible for us to do Beyond the Bricks from inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. Good evening to you on a night that Mike and I think if you've listened to this program for a while, you would know one of these two facts. Number one, Mike and I both huge fans of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And number two, we grew up in different areas. Myself in the Indianapolis area, Mike primarily in the Toledo, Ohio area. But Mike, it doesn't mean that even though we grew up in different areas, we probably didn't spend a lot of evenings or Sundays doing the same thing. And that was listening to popular radio, call-in radio, request radio, Casey Kasem's Top 40 Countdown, Rick D's, whatever it might be. And so you decided, you know what? That's what we should do. Let's do an all-request Beyond the Bricks. And that's what we're going to do tonight.
That's right. We've done this in the past a little bit, and people have responded to it, and they've sent in more questions. So I thought we should do it again. And I was hoping we could work in the Snuggles, Casey Kasem's Snuggles clip, but I think the station wants to keep its license, so we're not going to do that, I don't think, tonight.
That's right. Don't go playing it up. I don't want to come out of an upbeat song. That's a very esoteric inside radio joke, but I think most people probably
on the phone?
Know it. Right?
Is Don on the phone? I want to know what happened to the pictures I asked for.
Google Casey Kasem if you're not familiar with the joke. All right, let's get right to it. Lawrence is a suburb of Indianapolis. Not even a suburb, really. It's an incorporated area here. And that's where Eric lives. And Eric had a question for us and wanted to know, and this is a good one for you, Mike. I'll let you field it before we hear from the audio itself. And that is, and this is a good question. When you think about the early years of the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, one of the interesting facts about it is, you know, you think of the early names, you know, the Ralph DePalmas and the Gaston Chevrolets, the Joe Dawson, and of course, the first winner, Ray Haroun. And then you think about the marriage of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with radio and then later television. But the reality is that you didn't have that in the early years in terms of the coverage of it and obviously the technology of it. So Eric's question is a good one, Mike, and that is, what is that we know of the oldest, or I guess you would say the earliest audio involving Ray Haroun?
Yeah, I thought this actually was a really good question. And Eric wanted to know, what is the oldest audio that exists that Ray Haroun is heard, his voice is heard on? And I'm not aware of anything prior to World War II that Ray Haroun is on. So it's likely that it's a film that was made called The Crucible of Speed that Ray Haroun appears in. He has a bit part. It's kind of an interesting part that Ray Haroun, he's basically, I mean, they have a guy who's playing a reporter. He's not actually a reporter. The man's playing a role, and he's interviewing Wilbur Shaw. And then Wilbur Shaw says, basically, well, here's somebody you'll want to meet, and it's Ray Haroun. And it actually is. It's a 1946 film that was put out. And I believe that right now, this is the earliest audio that we have that Ray Haroon is, his voice is heard on.
This was, if I'm not mistaken, kind of funded by or put out by Firestone Tire, the Crucible of Speed, about everything that you just mentioned, Mike, from 1946.
Carl's writing a series of stories on the history of the race, and he's looking for some information.
If it's history you're interested in, here's a gentleman you should meet. Mr. Ray Haroon, winner of the first 500-mile race in 1911.
How do you do, sir?
How do you do? I'll be glad to help you, Mr. Reed. But remember, I go back 35 years. I'm really an old-timer.
So much the better. You know, lots of people have the idea that the Indianapolis race is nothing more than a sporting event. I'd like to tell them how much the race has contributed to the automotive industry.
It should be a great story and well worth telling. The car in which he won the first 500-mile race is just outside, and it has a gadget on I'm sure you'd be interested in seeing. It fits right in, doesn't it, Ray?
It does.
Well, let's go see it.
Don't expect to see anything very glamorous.
She was a beautiful automobile in her day.
Still beautiful to me.
Well, there she is.
Winner, 1911. A Marmon Wasp.
And it took a lot of courage to drive this baby.
This car is historic for several reasons, Mr. Reed. We designed this car to carry one man. I figured I could save weight and get more speed by riding alone. The job of the mechanic in those days was to watch behind and notify the driver when other cars were trying to pass. They claimed that it'd be dangerous for me to ride alone. So I rigged up this little gadget.
This, Mr. Reed, is the first rear vision mirror. It must have been a great race, Ray. I'd like to have seen it.
It was a great race, Wilbur, and I don't think anybody that saw it will ever forget it.
Ray Haroon would have been 67 years old at the time of that audio. The reality is, Mike, it is fascinating, obviously. You can feel the excitement coming through in terms of Ray Haroon and the acting that goes into that.
Yeah, acting might not have been Ray's forte, but one of the things that's also interesting, you may hear in the audio where they say, when they see the car, they say, it, you know, winner was actually painted. At one point, they had this kind of garish lettering painted on the car. It said winner 1911 on the hood, and it actually appeared that way before the car was repainted the way we know it today. But if you see the film, that's what they're referring to. They come around the corner and it in kind of garish lettering, it says, you know, winner 1911. And it's a little bit different than obviously what we see today, where it that's obviously not on the car anymore. If you look at the car today, it's painted. It's just a painted solid color.
And one of the things about the Marmon Wasp that of course made it so famous aside from that is indeed the aspect of the rearview mirror, which led to Mike, Eric with an inquiry and you with an opportunity to show just how kind-hearted and charitable we are when it comes to these sorts of things.
Well, Eric had a follow-up question, and since we're so nice, and we thought we'd allow Eric a second question, and he wanted to know why, since Ray Haroon, you know, won the race in 1911 as a, you know, in a single seat car, and all the other drivers had a riding mechanic, why didn't everybody basically come back in 1912 driving a single seater? And so that I thought that was also a pretty good question. So we went back in the archives, and Donald Davidson has the answer for us, and we'll let Donald answer that question.
Because the rules were changed for 1912 in AAA championship racing, that any race of 100 miles or more had to carry a riding mechanic. And so they became mandatory in 1912, and they remained mandatory through 1922. From 23 to 29, they were optional. They weren't banned or done away with. They were optional. And so all but one person went to single-seaters. And then in 1930, they were made mandatory again for whatever reason. And that was the case from 1930 through 1937.
So there's your answer. And Eric, we appreciate not only listening, but the questions themselves. If you are from the Indianapolis area, you are familiar that we're going to go from one side of town to the other, because now we will go to Danville, Indiana, just on the west side of Indianapolis. Phil has a question for us. actually, Phil didn't specify whether it's Danville, Indiana or Danville, Illinois. I'm going to say Indiana just because we're on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan in Indianapolis, or if you were listening to us in podcast form, we, of course, don't limit ourselves entirely, Mike, because we are worldwide, right, in terms of our audience.
That's right. We reach everywhere.
So we'd like to think, right? Here is the question, though, that Phil wanted to know. He wanted to know if it's really true that mechanics basically borrowed a part off a passenger car in the infield during the Indy 500. Now, explain what exactly the question means and what we're going to hear here, Mike.
Yeah, the question revolves around a story that it's one of those stories that sounds that it's made up, but it actually did happen, that mechanics, you know, a part failed on a car in the race, and mechanics happened to see the same kind of car in the infield and said, hey, we need that part. And they actually basically jacked up the car in the infield, took the part they needed, borrowed it, used it in the race, and then ended up putting the part back on the car so that the person could drive home after the race. It sounds like a made-up story. It really does. But as Donald will tell us from a bit from the Talk of Gasoline Alley in 2007, this is an absolutely true story.
Okay, this is the historian emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and, of course, the host of Talk of Gasoline Alley, Donald Davidson.
It sounds like it's made up, but it actually was reported at the time. And the driver was Chet Miller, who was making his first 500 start. He was the guy who years later would drive the Novi and become one of the real standout veterans at the Speedway. But in 1930, he's making his first start. So they put this car together for just a few hundred dollars. And it's basically Ford Model T parts.
Yeah.
So anyway, the race is going on, and everybody gets very spread out because Billy Arnold's running away with the thing, and some of the have-nots are still rolling around at a much lesser speed. So Chet Miller comes in to make a pit stop at just past the halfway mark, and he's just about to go back into competition when an eagle-eyed official comes over and said, you can't go back in because your right front spring has broken.
Uh-oh.
And so he says, well, he said, yeah, I know, but that's okay. I'm a dirt track driver, and I've been able to, you know, counteract the situation, and it's okay. But the official said, no, it's broken, and you can't go back in with it like that. So they look around. They don't have a spare. So they look around, and in those days, there's no bleachers behind the pits. Up until 1946 was the first year had bleachers. In 41 and earlier, if you were early enough, you could actually drive your car up behind the pits and park your car and sit up on the car roof and watch all the pit stops. So these fellows, they look out and they see a Ford Model T. And again, I'm making a long version out of this story, but let me stress right here.
It's a wonderful story.
Well, it's not made up. It's actually reported in the magazines the following week in 1930. They see this Ford Model T. They go running out there. They look around for the owner, and he's nowhere to be found. And the car has exactly the piece of equipment that they want. So they jack up the car and remove the spring, bring it into the pits, put it onto the funny Ford, and after a 40-minute pit stop, Chet Miller, with relief from a guy named Paul Bost, whom I met in my early years at the track, go out, and they're still running at the end of the race, many, many laps behind, but they get 13th place. So they then think, well, we've got to give this fellow his spring back. So they remove it from the fronty Ford and then take it out, and the car's still out there, and a lot of people have gone now, but there's a traffic jam and the flow out through the tunnels to go home, and the Ford passenger car is still sitting there. So they reinstall the spring, and apparently the owner was never aware of
totally
the transaction.
Now that is a obviously very participating caller, and Donald Davidson back in 2007 from the Talk of Gasoline Alley. By the way, the fronty Ford started 15th, finished 13th for Chet Miller, the first of his 16 starts at the Indianapolis 500. All right, so we are talking about everything that is taking place at the Indianapolis 500 in terms of this, our listener participation night, because that's what we do, Mike. We are taking all the hits and playing all the requests right here. We'll continue to do so as we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Ane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there, but you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at Kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, Mike Thompson. My name is Jake Query. Landon Coons here as well. I feel like it's a racing radio party, Mike. With the last time that you, Mike, called a radio station to request a song, what song was it, if you had to guess?
Men Without Hats, The Safety Dance. And that was last week.
That's right. That's right. You want me to just sit here and do the S-S-S-S-A-A-A?
You can ask my wife. I actually do the dance, which is, there's not a lot to it. It's just basically moving your arms in the air. If the song comes on, I will do the dance in front of her. And she gives me the biggest eye roll you'll ever see every time I do the dance.
I am a fan. That song, when it came out, was absolutely huge. Of course, now they have an Indy 500 variation of it, just simply called the Safer Barrier, which hopefully is a dance that a lot of people do not undertake, which leads to a trivia question. Mike, do you recall when the Safer Barrier was first put into the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the first driver to make contact with it during practice in the year that it was installed and first used?
The first driver who made contact, I believe, was Robbie McGee.
That is correct. Robbie McGee, who got out, and that was when, of course, Tom Carnegie, as he got out of the car, said, "Tall, angular, Robbie McGee, good-looking young man." And then he, of course, did an interview talking about his gratitude for the Safer Barrier, because he did have some lower ankle injuries, but that was it, and he limped away from said accident. All right, we're getting to our listener requests, if you will, the questions they had. Frank in Omaha writes in. Frank says, was there ever a driver in the 500 named Bunny? Well, there was a driver whose nickname was Bunny. Donald Davidson has the story of Overton Phillips that he stole on, on the Talk of Gasoline Alley about 15 years ago.
Overton Phillips went by the nickname of Bunny. You sometimes see him referred to as Bunny Phillips. And I never met him. And he passed away not that long ago. And I was surprised to learn that he was still around. And I think he was up, golly, not too far from 90 or right around 90 years old, I think. But as far as Indianapolis was concerned, he was here in 1937 driving the Mannix-Duesenberg Special, and there was an accident involving a car that he drove during practice, which crashed into the pits, and at a time when we didn't have a separated pit lane, the cars would all sort of be lined up against the wall, and he spun around, and there was a hit a car that Vern Orenduff was going to try and qualify, and there were two people that lost their lives, and one of them was a fireman named George Warford, who had been a dirt track driver, and an Otto Rohde, who was an engineer with the Champion Spark Plug Company. The next time that he, and so Bunny Phillips was very briefly hospitalized. He didn't come back again until 1940, and it was an odd arrangement. He had a Bugatti with a Miller engine, a straight 8 Miller in a Bugatti chassis, and he qualified in 40 but got bumped, and it ran as the Phillips Special, so it kind of hides what it really was. And then in 41, he finished 13th with Mel Hansen as the relief driver, and I think probably finishing the race. And then comes the war years. 13th, if I didn't mention, was the finish. Then comes the war years, and then in 46, he entered the car, but not to drive himself. And Hal Robson, George Robson's brother, drove it, still with the straight 8 Miller in the Bugatti chassis. And he lived in Los Angeles, I think in Beverly Hills, as a matter of fact, and had a restoration. He did restoration on Bugattis, and I wish I'd known that he was still around, because I say, when I was very surprised when I learned that he had passed away, and I thought, I didn't know he was still alive, and I do not recall what year that was, but it was that long ago.
By the way, Bunny is also the nickname of the father of Willie T. Ribbs, one of the great personalities and, of course, historical drivers, the first African-American to qualify for the Indianapolis 500, as he did for the first time back in 1991. Love Willie T. Ribbs. Absolutely love him. Kai in Ohio, a new fan of the show, Mike, right?
That's correct.
Kai said that he's interested in pit stops and wanted to hear the audio from a famous pit stop during the course of the race. Why not go to one that takes place just inside of fewer than 20 laps remaining in the 1987 Indianapolis 500-mile race, when Roberto Guerrero came into the pits and it was called on the IMS radio network?
And with that time stop, you heard Lou Palmer talk about it. Here it is now, Lou.
Roberto Guerrero is in. They top him. Sonny Myers is extra man on this side of the wall, my side, in order to hold the hose, in order to be sure all of the fuel they need does get in. They're looking at that gauge now, getting closer and closer to it. Looking, two, three, one. Now they're about to shut off. There goes the first, second, third switch closed. They've disengaged. He stalls the engine. Now, back the inertial starter. It is in. Roberto Guerrero fires again. It catches quickly. Luckily, they push him off, and both catch fully. Now it does engage. Now it doesn't. A very slow pull away at the south end of the pit. The bond, it has stopped, virtually stopped.
And Roberto Al Unser picks up the lead of the race as Guerrero stops on the pits. Al Unser picks up the race. The crowd comes to a stand. Guerrero sits silently in the pits. Let's go back to Lou Palmer. Lou.
All right. We're looking now at the car being pushed back this way. They are not only losing some distance on the track, they are losing time. Here he comes now. They are pushing right back to the pit area. Now they are going further back. Roberto Guerrero attempting to get the car precisely positioned. No, they're going to try to push start it. That's what they're doing. Like pushing a kid down the hill with a sled. The inertial starter isn't being used. It's plain old foot power. He catches. He is on his way. Roberto Guerrero loses time, but is at least back in the race.
Of course, we would later find out that the cause for Roberto Guerrero's stalled engine would be the fact that early in the race, it was struck by a tire that had come off of Tony Bettenhausen's car, and that jarred loose just a little bit the gearbox. It ultimately turned out to be what would do in the race for Roberto Guerrero. Al Unser would go on to win his fourth Indianapolis 500, of course, in 1987. Now, Jim in Plainfield, speaking of Lou Palmer, remembers when Lou Palmer did his daily reports that ran on WIBC. We've done this before, but wanted to do it again. If you wanted to hear a daily report from Lou Palmer, here is one with a lot in it from 1982.
A break in the day's activity just a little earlier than scheduled, and for most, it seemed that was all right. The threat of rain. It existed in the central Indiana area through most of the day, and the threat became intense enough that they gave us the yellow light, and people went streaming back into the garage area with tool chests, tires, and even the competition equipment themselves. The drivers walking in a little later. Everybody able to beat the rain in, but the threat itself gave us the yellow a little early. Still, 25 cars made it out on the track. 25, better than the two dozen on Monday, and speeds a little better for some of those not yet in the field. For Chet Phillip, his run equaled 194.2 mile an hour in car 39. And Dale Whittington was approaching 194 miles an hour as he picks up speed little by little in car 95. He completed his driver's test in it on Monday, moves to near 194 on Tuesday, continuing to gain in a car one of the brothers had out at better than 200 miles an hour. That March ought to qualify well in the weekend ahead. And Bobby Unser continued to gain ground, car 55, setting it up for Jose Lee's qualification effort this coming weekend. Bobby himself, still not a man who indicates he's going to qualify for this year's race. Bill Alsup wants to. He is now above 190 miles an hour in car number two. But for the others not yet qualified, not close to those speeds, not yet. For those who have qualified, Danny Ongais continued to work on race day setup near 199 miles an hour. A.J. Foyt approaching 197. And Bob Rahal in the 197 mile an hour range as well in car number 19. Howdy Holmes, who had qualified, also used the track to run race-ready setups. And John Rutherford was out. But the Pennzoil Chaparral he was driving was not the car qualified, but rather the backup 5T, out on the track and taking laps. Taking their first laps for the month of May, John Mailer, he was in car number 92, and Phil Kruger made a first appearance in car number 89. And John Martin in a couple of cars, trying to set them, car 17, and then a little later, car number 27. So all in all, for those not yet qualified, but running a better than 190 mile an hour lap on a Tuesday, Chet Phillip, Dale Whittington, Bill Alsup, and for Jose Lee Garza, Bobby Unser. For the speed line, know the track was good enough that Danny Ongais could crack near 199 miles an hour on a rain-threatened afternoon of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Mike, I noticed it was Bob Rahal and John Rutherford back in those days, although John would have obviously been known as Johnny Rutherford as well.
Yeah, Lou Palmer obviously had a way with words, but there's a lot of interesting things to unpack in there. Obviously, it was Bobby Rahal's rookie year. Dale Whittington made the race, but he was involved in the first, you know, the accident at the start, the accident with Kevin Kogan and Mario and Roger Mears. And that was his only appearance, and he didn't do a lap. So he's one of those drivers who didn't complete a lap in his only 500. So there's a lot of interesting things. But one of the interesting things I think was there was Bobby Unser shaking down the car for Jose Lee Garza. Garza had been the rookie of the year the previous year, and then in his second year had all kinds of problems just trying to get up to speed. And so Bobby was out there shaking down the car. And then there was a lot of discussion whether Bobby was going to get in a backup Penske car that weekend or a backup Patrick car. He had several offers, and ultimately he was the team manager. He had taken that role for Jose Lee, and ultimately trying to get Jose Lee in the race, Bobby decided not to drive anything. So the defending champion ended up sitting out the race.
And of course, Bobby Unser won that. As a result of that, you could still say started last in his first race and first in his last race. Alan in Pennsylvania would like to know, speaking of Lou Palmer, he contributes again to this program because the question was, how much audio is there from Mark Donahue, winner of the 1972 Indianapolis 500, of course, the first win for Roger Penske? And there is some audio of Mark Donahue because he would do, back in those days, you know, sports car audio and different things and promotional films within his career. But in terms of the Indianapolis 500 and audio from Mark Donahue, who, of course, would pass at a young age after winning the Indy 500 in 1972, we go back to Lou Palmer and his interview with Mark Donahue in Victory Lane from the 1972 Indy 500.
And Mark Donahue has arrived in Victory Lane. And the first kiss, I don't think, was from our queen, the 500 Festival Queen at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mark Donahue sitting high at back of the car, his day to day. Did you get, welcome home, Mark. It's been a fight, hasn't it?
Well, this is really the happiest moment of my life. And I really owe a lot to Carl Kienhoffer and Roger Penske and all the guys that worked so hard for to get to this point. We had some good luck, and it's kind of a change for us, I guess. But our whole team worked really well, and I just can't express how happy I am.
Well, hey, we're happy to have you here. And you were really racing at the end. It was almost like a sprint event, not a 500 mile. You and Grant were having something of a go out there. Did you know how close it was, and how about a sip of milk before you answer? Go ahead, Mark. Take a sip. All right. Hey, and you've got to be thirsty as well as happy. Another one.
It's very good.
you met our queen.
Hi.
Congratulations. All right. Another reason to arrive in victory lane. Now, about that duel at the end, man, it really looked like it was pushing. You and Jerry, you were really racing each other out there. Were you aware how tight that contest was?
Well, yeah. Roger told me all along what was happening, and we'd kind of agreed to start racing a little bit towards the end of the race, and the car was pushing a bit, so we couldn't go as fast as we wanted, but unfortunately, I think Jerry had some little bad engine luck at the end, and that was a break for us.
How about the heat today? Was this a tiring race for you? You've had other 500 miles here.
Well, every race is a tiring race, but one is not very tired if he happens to win.
Where is Roger? I'm looking around and I don't... We're getting some pictures taken here now, Sid, at the moment. As we say, the congratulations are really being heaped upon Mark Donahue, who finally made it home to victory lane here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Larry, have you seen Roger Penske?
Right over here.
Let's get him up in here. Come on up here. You really...
Some more thirst, right?
Again, Mark, we congratulate you thoroughly. And is any further comment before we get to Mark concerning the performance of the car or the crew or the sponsors?
I just couldn't be happier, quite frankly.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Mark Donahue.
Mark Donahue would be fatally injured in a crash during the Austrian Grand Prix practice on August 19th of 1975. But that audio from the 56th Indianapolis 500-mile race, Victory Lane, where he would win on May 27th of 1972. We come back, go ahead and grab your favorite side, mashed potatoes, corn, whatever it might be, because we're going to discuss a little chicken. Not necessarily winner-winner chicken dinner, but chicken sponsors. We'll get to all of that when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Ane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Al Unser, the 1970 Indy 500 champion, races the 1969 Indy winner Mario Andretti. They're racing Johnny Lightning cars on the Indy 500 set.
Zoomy, fantastic.
Flashing through the curves, fighting it out on the straights. The Indy 500 means hours of fun and thrills for everyone. The Indy 500. Have a ball with cars and sets from Johnny Lightning.
Can I win?
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, Beyond the Bricks, Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons putting it together for us. That clip, of course, with the Johnny Lightning special and Al Unser. Mike, I think safe to say, and I will not too, you know, dangerously speak for the masses here, but in the time that we have done this show and certainly just being out and about and spending time within the culture community of the memorabilia of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, as I know you do, there are a number of great cars and famous cars and beloved cars within the history of IMS. But if you were to make a top five list, I think the Johnny Lightning special, absolutely for its time period, is the one that you would hear, if not the highest, a very high percentage of people that would tell you that was their favorite car.
Oh, I agree with that. Yeah, it's definitely in the top five for a lot of people, their favorite liveries, paint schemes of all time. for sure. That one comes up all the time. The Jack Villeneuve player's car. The one you mentioned a lot is the Danny Sullivan car, the 85 car. That comes up. The Jim Clark Lotus comes up a lot. You know, those are the ones I think you hear a lot. So, yeah, I agree. The Johnny Lightning car is probably top of mind for a lot of people.
The Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indy 500 both are so deep and deeply rich in terms of tradition. And, yes, fried chicken has always been a popular dish, delicacy, something you bring with you, whether it be a boxed lunch that you got from Kroger, whether it be going to Hollyhock Hill in Indianapolis with your family if you're in town for the race, whether it be Alex Palou, current driver today, who always says winner, chicken dinner when he wins a race and says he celebrates with fried chicken, although I think he has admitted that he's backed off of that just a little bit, and he's winning a lot of races, obviously, these days. But Jeremy, who did not happen to provide a city, by the way. Now, do we know what state Jeremy's from by any chance, Mike?
No, we don't. We don't have a city, a state. We don't have anything. We have no information whatsoever on Jeremy. Jeremy, I think he wanted to stay a little bit secretive. So Jeremy wanted to put in a request, but I think he wanted to stay a little bit under the radar.
So what you're saying is he was chicken, right?
I don't want to go that far. I mean, he was nice enough to send in a request, but he didn't want to provide too much information about himself.
Well, his request was he wanted to know about a chicken-related car from the 1960s. And initially, Mike, I think you were thinking, well, maybe he's thinking of Rich Vogler's ride in the 80s that was sponsored by Kentucky Fried Chicken. But then once you started thinking about it, you thought maybe it was the Speedy's Broasted Chicken Special driven by Chuck Booth that he was referencing. Donald Davidson on that car and that sponsorship from an episode of Talk of Gasoline Alley from 2006.
He was a sprint car driver. He drove championship races, but the Speedy's Broasted Chicken Special, I thought that was one of the all-time great car names.
Sure.
And that was about a shoestring operation. It was one of the Huffaker cars from 1966. It was an MG liquid suspension car, but not the 64, 65 ones that were Bob Veith and Walter Hanskin and Jerry Grant, and then later on Wally Dallenbach. They were two cars. There were four of those cars because Gordon Van Loo had two. Bobby Unser drove one, but the Bob Veith and Bob Christie and all kinds of other people were in and out of the other two, neither of which made it. And it was one of those that came into the hands of Frank Fiore. And Speedy's Broasted Chicken was Frank Fiore's sister. I don't know what her name was. But it was a stock block Chevy, and they ran it with Chuck several days, and it could never get started on the first phase of the rookie test. All it could do was practice. It never ran fast enough for the first phase. But dear old Frank, they came back the next year with the same car. And this time it was Dave Strickland, a midget driver who drove it for a while, and then Dee Jones was in it. And it never went to the qualifying line because it wouldn't run fast enough for Dave Strickland to start the rookie test.
Now, Mike, when it comes to this show, and, you know, you'd mentioned Jeremy, who was a little bit like, you know, off radar, didn't necessarily want the attention for his question. Understood, right? Sometimes there are those that call into live radio programs, like yourself, requesting Men Without Hats safety dance, as you did last week, that they then become part of the show just because sometimes call-ins become so outlandish. Now, I've done talk radio for a long time. I love it. I know that. I love people that call in and create that kind of a memory. And that's one of them that we have here to kind of close things out. You say we're going out with a doozy, right?
Yeah, this is a doozy. Now, when we talk about the great calls of the Talk of Gasoline Alley, I mean, we had legendary, I mean, Hall of Fame people, Jerry from Delphi, you know, I mean, Dave from Marion. Those were like legendary callers. You knew when they called in, you were going to get something good. They were going to bring something to the table. You know, Mike from Vernon Hills. I mean, these are the Hall of Fame. If you had a Hall of Fame that we could build, you know, statues or busts of the Hall of Fame callers, because they always called in and they had really good topics, really interesting things. Now, going back to Jeremy, by the way, thinking about Jeremy for one second, I mean, would you want to provide your personal information to us? Probably not. So I understand Jeremy's, you know, reluctance to provide a city.
We understand, right? So,
yeah, I understand. But going back to this particular question, we had a question which was asked by a listener who asked to remain anonymous, maybe because they thought we would reject this submission, but we accepted it. The question is, what was the worst call in the history of the Talk of Gasoline Alley? Now, don't forget, the Talk of Gasoline Alley was on, you know, for 40 years. So plus, you know, it started in the 70s and it ended in 2020. So, I mean, that's a, you know, decades it was on. So, you know, that's a bit subjective to say what's the one single worst call of all time. It would be hard for me to pick one call out. But if we were going to make a list of calls that were the worst calls of all time, I would put this call that we're about to play on that list, and I'll let everyone else decide if they think it belongs. Jake, you get to decide as well whether you think this call belongs. But this, to me, would absolutely be on the list of one of the worst calls of all time for the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Okay, this is Kevin Calabro, Donald Davidson. Kevin Calabro was working with Donald. Donald, the host of the show, back in 1981.
Donald Davidson speaking. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have two questions, and I was wondering if you still counted people if they stumped you.
Well, we don't have any prizes to give you, but we'll take a crack at it because we got off on a slow note, and we want to get the trivia going. So what's your question?
Okay. First question is, do you know who was killed in a regular practice session and what year?
Well, that happened several times.
Who's the last person?
The last person to be killed in a practice session would have been Art Pollard in 1973.
No, that was a qualification day.
Well, it was an open practice session.
No, it's just a regular practice before qualification.
Okay. Okay, Jim Malloy was killed in 72, but that was also a qualification day, although he wasn't on a qualifying attempt. So it would be then Mike Spence in 1968. Is that what you got?
Just a minute. Mike Spence?
We came prepared, didn't we?
Well, we have...
Mike Spence
was... in 1965.
Mike, say again?
Bill Peterbaugh in 1965.
Fatally injured? He looked awfully healthy when I saw him the other day.
Well, somebody said that he
I'm sure that Bill would be very sorry to hear that.
Yeah, Bill, you're dead. Huh?
It was in a trivia. And somebody, that's what the answer was that they said.
Okay.
I don't know what you got, but I can tell you there were no fatal accidents at all in 65. The last one was Mike Spence, and I think it was May 7th of 68.
Thank you for calling us. We got to move along.
Poor old Peterbaugh. Boy.
Bill,
I don't
kid,
know
huh?
what kind of a trivia quiz that was, but I think that's wrong.
I do, too. And the guy the other night that asked you about the wrecks, which turn had the more wrecks?
Oh, yes.
That was another gruesome...
Yeah.
Sunny in 71 at WIBC. We'll be right back.
No, we were mystified because the lady's question was, what was the last time a person was fatally injured on a practice day that was not a qualifying day? And her answer was Bill Peterbaugh in 1965. And, you know, so I'm walking around the other day, 16 years later, so he... I don't know what their source is.
Right.
1981. Now, here's the other question. Was that, Mike, a woman calling in or a little kid calling in?
It sounded like it might have been a younger kid, but Bill Peterbaugh, I want to point out, passed away in 2017. And so much later than 1981, but that there's a lot to unpack from that call because you have someone calling in, they ask a trivia question, trying to stump Donald to get a prize. Then they don't have the answer correct. Then they want to argue with Donald about what's a practice, you know, session and what's not. I mean, there was a lot to unpack in that. Clearly, Kevin Calabro was annoyed with the call, and then he's doing, you know, ghost noises at the end. I mean,
so, yeah, the ghost noises at the end were, and then followed by a quick weather report, right?
Yeah. So there was, to me, that's one of the leaders in the clubhouse for the worst call of all time for the talk of gasoline. Now, again, you call in and you want to argue with the expert. The whole thing was just so strange. And then for them to keep, throughout the rest of the show, they just keep repeatedly going back while other callers are asking about other things. They're just so gobsmacked by how bad that call was. They keep referring to it.
You know, calling in to ask a question for Donald Davidson and then challenge him on it is probably like in 2025 requesting Men Without Hats safety dance on All Request Night, right? Probably not.
Well, I think that was a good thing I did. And then then previous to that, for my birthday, I requested, I wanted to have You Know My Name, Look Up the Number played on the Beatles show, on the Breakfast with the Beatles show. And they did do that for me. They played that and they played Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. They played a double bill just for me on my birthday.
Whether it be anonymous, whether it be with your name and hometown, we appreciate the questions, the inquiries on this request night of Beyond the Bricks.
With the Wealthfront Cash Account, you can earn 4% annual percentage yield from partner banks on your cash until you're ready to invest. The Cash Account grows your money with no account maintenance fees and free instant withdrawals whenever you need it. Money works better here. Go to Wealthfront.com to start saving and investing today. Cash Account offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. Wealthfront is not a bank. The APY on cash deposits as of December 27, 2024 is representative, subject to change and requires no minimum. Funds in the cash account are swept to partner banks where they earn the variable APY.